Going once. Would you take your seats, please? Gentlemen, this next paper will discuss the EMU, that stands for Extra Vehicular Mobility Unit. I looked it up in the dictionary, and as you probably know, EMU is also a bird. It's the second largest land bird, smaller only than an ostrich. There's also, it turns out, in Australia, an EMU tree and an EMU bush. But one of the things that interested me in a dictionary that I looked in anyhow was the next word was EMULATE. Now, I don't know whether that has anything to do with schedules or not, but I hope you don't emulate some of the other parts of the program where we've had schedule difficulties. This is Bill Kincaid.
Aside from being a large flightless bird living in Australia, the EMU is in reality a spacecraft module in itself, operating completely independent of the other modules while on the lunar surface. It contains its own communications, electrical power, and environmental control systems. Its guidance and navigation, propulsion, reaction control systems are in reality the astronaut working in conjunction with the EMU. As you've seen, the EMU consists of seven major subassemblies, a liquid-cooled undergarment, the base pressure suit assembly itself, a back-mounted portable life support system, a thermal meteorite garment which encompasses the entire assembly, shown here in cross-section, lunar boots, lunar gloves, and an extravehicular over-protective visor. In addition to the lunar exploration requirement, the EMU also allows the astronaut to leave the spaceship in free space to perform an extravehicular transfer in either direction in event of a docking system malfunction. As in Gemini and Mercury, the spacesuit provides backup protection within the spacecraft in event of an unscheduled cabin loss pressure. The suit is capable of being self-donned rapidly, under 5 minutes, such that in event of a non-catastrophic type depressurization, the crew will have time to don the suit. And thereby, this allows the astronauts, of course, to select various phases of the mission in which they can operate unsuited as they desire. The specific requirements on the EMU for the lunar mission are that it allow explorations of the lunar surface for distances of at least 0.5 nautical miles from the limb, that it provide 4 hours of continuous separation from the spacecraft for each excursion, and a total of 24 hours. The 4 hours has since been further redefined to be 3 hours nominal with 1 hour contingency. The 24 hours is accomplished by 8 total missions of 3 hours apiece, 4 per EMU. The EMU also must permit the crewmen to be extravehicular at the same time. It also has to permit recharge within an hour to provide quick turnaround. The main function of the portable life support system, of course, is to control and replenish the atmosphere within the spacesuit. The unit, which weighs 65 pounds, provides control of CO2, pressure, and other toxic gases. It has a capacity for 4,800 BTUs total of metabolic expenditure. It can handle metabolic rates on the average over the total mission of up to 1,600 BTUs per hour, and is designed to accommodate peak loads for periods of 10 minutes of up to 2,000 BTUs per hour. In reality, testing in the past few months has shown that the backpack will actually handle over 3,000 for short periods. However, of course, the expendables are used at an accelerated rate and thereby shortening the mission. The backpack also has a capability to accommodate external heat leaks into the system of 250 BTUs per hour or 350 BTUs per hour out. The design of the thermal garment around the 250 BTUR figure has dictated that the heat leak out won't exceed 200 BTUs per hour in most cases. Thermal control is achieved through a unique approach which does not rely on crew sweating. This is accomplished by circulating cool water from the PLSS through the blue loop you see here into the suit, into the liquid cool undergarment, which has tubes in direct contact with the skin. Thereby, the heat is collected by the water through conduction and pumped back into the PLSS, recycled through a heat exchanger and back into the unit. The gas ventilation loop is still required, however, of course, to control the pressure and maintain the partial pressures of oxygen and CO2. This is accomplished through the green loop in a more or less conventional means as the present environmental spacecraft systems are designed. We have a lithium hydroxide canister, a force plate sublimator heat exchanger, a fan, and back into the suit. We use high pressure oxygen. The total capacity of this tank is 1 pound of oxygen for the 4-hour mission. We use coolant water in the water sublimator. We have 8 pounds. And we have replaceable lithium hydroxide cartridges that contain about 3 pounds of lithium hydroxide. The battery is also replaceable. It's not rechargeable. And we carry enough to accommodate the 8 extravehicular missions. The flow rates in the gas loop, of course, have been substantially reduced because now we don't have to cool the astronaut through the gas system. We've been able to reduce the flows from somewhere around 15 to 20 CFM without water cooling to only 6 CFM, which is dumped directly in the helmet, circulated over the body, and returned. A typical maximum integrated metabolic profile is shown in this next slide. These profiles are used primarily in testing the portable life support system, putting it through its paces, both manned and unmanned. In manned tests, we work the astronaut to these profiles. You can see here that maximum energy at 2,000 BTUs per hour is taken to be hard work. Moderate work levels will be 1,600 BTUs per hour. Moderate work being erecting experiments and what have you. Light work, such as checkout, instrumentation checks, will be around 1,000 BTUs per hour, and the resting rate of 400 BTUs per hour. Of course, in the actual profile of the man on the moon, the profile will be a series of peaks and valleys rather than plateaus and sharply defined points. We probably will exceed the 2,000 BTU per hour figure quite often. However, as I stated, the backpack has a capacity to keep the man cool during these conditions. This is a fairly intense work period for a fairly long time, and it's expected that the astronaut will have to take a break now and then and rest a while. The PLSS also houses the communications system, which was covered previously by Mr. Broom. It also houses a 7-channel telemetry system, which provides data back to Earth in the form of expendable coolant quantity remaining, primary oxygen quantity remaining, battery power remaining, and suit conditions, total suit pressure, the liquid cool garment delta T, that is inlet and outlet of the water to the garment, so that we can assess the metabolic rates that the astronaut will be putting out to perform various tasks, suit inlet temperature, and also the electrocardiogram as being the biomedical monitor on the astronaut. The astronaut himself will have available to him a total suit pressure gauge, a gauge of his oxygen quantity remaining, gauge of his water quantity, and he also has 2 audible warning signals to tell him when his suit pressure has reached a low position. He must take corrective action, and also when his oxygen flow is becoming excessive. He also has available to him an independent oxygen supply, the emergency oxygen system, which you see here on the right. Shown on the left is an example of how we've been able to reduce the volume and weight of this unit since the past few months. This unit originally weighed 5.5 pounds. This one now weighs 3.2, and it's an example of the steps we've taken to make the units more compact such that we don't encumber the suit. It's a green apple device. It's also shown up here. That is, it's actuated by pulling a green apple. It's a one-shot deal. It's not rechargeable. It feeds oxygen into the helmet directly and will provide for emergencies of 5 minutes to 38 minutes, depending on the failure mode and the time at which it occurs. The pressure garment assembly, as you've seen before, consists of a basic torso section, intervehicular helmet, gloves, and boots. Unlike its predecessors, this pressure suit attains its mobility through the use of convoluted bellows joints. The advantage of these joints is that when they are flexed, they don't significantly change the volume of the gas in the suit. Thereby, the astronaut is not required to work against compressing the gas in the suit. Joints are located at the shoulders, elbows, wrists, thighs, knees, and since this suit was produced, we've added an ankle joint to facilitate walking. The suit provides a basic protection against the environments of the moon and the mobility to accomplish the mission. It also has the capability for body waste storage, distributes the ventilation from the backpack, and so on. It also has to be tolerable for continuous wear for up to 115 hours, which is the worst case abort for a depressurized vehicle. We've run suit subjects in these garments for long periods of time, and right now we're confident that he's going to be able to do this adequately. Bearings are also located in the shoulder and the wrist to facilitate rotating the arms and the wrists. Visor fogging, which occurred during the GT-9 experiment, has been and will continue to be given a great deal of consideration in the EMU test program. Fogging, of course, occurs by the condensation of the wet expired breath and the gas ventilation stream on a cold inner surface of the visor. We've conducted tests in a lunar night environment at 300,000 feet with cold walls at minus 300 degrees and the subject working at metabolic rates ranging from 400 to 2,000 BTUs without any significant fogging. We found that the subject could create fogging by purposely directly orienting his breath against the visor. However, the small patch which did appear cleared up within 1 to 2 seconds. We're also going to coat the visor with a low emissivity coating to control the temperature, and we're looking strongly at wetting agent coatings to preclude visor fogging. The visor is made of polycarbonate, which was selected primarily for its impact strength. 1/4 inch of polycarbonate will sustain energy loads of 80 foot-pounds without breakage. This is particularly important to the astronaut in Apollo because he's going to be moving around on the lunar surface and will be exposed to bulkheads and brackets intervehicularly. For comparison, the Mercury and Gemini visors were made out of acrylic or plexiglass, which broke at energy levels of 5 foot-pounds. Of course, this was acceptable because the spacesuit didn't have to leave the couch. Now, we also conducted tests in a 160 airplane to see just what kind of impact loads we could expect. Now, this certainly would be the worst case. The subject has on a fiberglass helmet here for a test setup. During these tests, we sustained loads of 135 foot-pounds. That's a gutsy maneuver, believe me. However, the subject said that the blow was not much worse than a good hard tackle, so he came through quite well. The polycarbonate helmet and extravehicular visor assembly would be able to withstand a load like that without breakage. Polycarbonates are relatively new, and production process controls and fabrication techniques need some more work. Right now, we're having a problem producing a quality helmet consistently. While this problem is still existing, we have several contractors investigating it, and we expect to be able to qualify the helmet by January 67. Visor optics are particularly important with the primary visor because we have to interface with the guidance and navigation eyepieces, and it's a fairly touchy interface as far as optics go. I want to say another word about provisions to store body waste within the spacesuit. We're using right now the Gemini collection bag for urine. It's identical, in fact, except for a few minor interface revisions, except that we can dump the bag and reuse it in flight. Fecal storage is not expected to occur during planned pressurized suit operations. However, during the emergency return of 115 hours, we have to make provisions to contain it. This is one of the most difficult problems we've had to date. We've investigated numerous systems, and none have really been satisfactory. The system we're now playing with is a diaper approach whereby we contain it but make no provisions to take it out of the suit or store it. This is the liquid-cooled spacesuit, which contains over 300 feet of polyvinyl tubing. Water's pumped through it at about 4 pounds a minute. The astronaut has a control over the inlet temperature of temperatures ranging from 45 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit, depending upon his activity level. We've run three-hour manned mission profiles with the garment, numerous manned mission profiles, and as a rule, the astronaut doesn't have to make a lot of changes to the temperature control to maintain comfort. He's able to, in most cases, accommodate this with six complete motions throughout the three-hour period. The thermal meteorite garment is worn over the entire pressure suit assembly. Its primary objectives, of course, are to preclude abrasion and cuts of the primary suit. It provides meteorite protection and passive thermal control to limit the heat influx, outflux, and also to eliminate hot spots. It has a donned-off capability to not really prevent, but limit the contamination back into the command module from the lunar surface. And of course, it's much more easy to operate without the TMG in the intervehicular phases of the mission. Insulation has also been added to the suit. They aren't obvious here, to in areas of that we expect to contact the moon, such as the boots, gloves, knees, what have you. Although mobility is not appreciably degraded by the addition of the garment, this is not really true in areas of the glove and boots, which by their nature are small. The gloves have a fine woven stainless steel palm for durability, backed by 16 layers of super insulation for conduction protection. The remainder of the glove and the gauntlet are as the thermal meteorite cross-section. And this is shown in a test rig that we conducted here a few weeks ago, whereby we're injecting the glove into a high vacuum chamber to see how long we can hold on to hot and cold objects. We were able to hold on to this rod at 250 degrees for 3 minutes. At minus 250 degrees, we're able to hold it for 13 minutes or more. Dexterity and finger tactility are hard to maintain, as you can imagine, with the bulk of the glove here. However, we do feel we have a glove that will allow the astronaut to perform a useful function in conjunction with experiments. The lunar boots are not as problematic as the glove in that they don't require the tactility and gripping and what have you. However, we're trying to maintain sole flexure here with a fairly thick sole to allow him to walk with greater ease. This particular sole is made out of a neoprene rubber, which holds up surprisingly well on sharp rocks and what have you, backed by, again, many layers of super insulation and finally two layers of Nomex felt. Unmanned testing of the thermal garments has been underway since 1963. We've done a good deal of swatch testing to come up with cross-sections and materials. In fact, we've optimized the garment from 25 layers down to 7 layers. Throughout this test program, access flaps have been purposely left open to examine hot spots. We've purposely dusted the outside surface of the garment with lunar soil. And To date, we have noticed a... Did I get some feedback there? To purposely examine the thermal degradation, and we did get some. However, it was still well within the capacity of the portable life support system. The extravehicular visor assembly is worn over the primary helmet. This is a prototype. Its method of mounting on the helmet is still the same. However, we've gone from a three-visor absorptivity type to a two-visor over-assembly, which relies on reflecting the thermal and visual light that we don't want coming through the visor. I'll demonstrate when the subject comes out that this can be easily lowered and raised. It's held in position by a friction cam, and the particular mock-up we have has lost some of its friction characteristics, so we may have a problem. This is a test setup in this next film of one of the tests we've run on the EMU. The grid, quartz lamp grid here, is of course the infrared source of heat. The bright flash you'll see here soon is the solar simulator coming on. The chamber has cold walls at about minus 10, minus 4 torr. We can rotate the specimen on the longitudinal axis to examine transient situations and look at different view factors. We're getting ready, in fact, to run with the garments you'll see out here in a few minutes at LTV in the next few weeks to examine another more difficult situation. Even though the Apollo suit is the best available, it still requires some metabolic energy to operate. We've done a lot of metabolic testing to just see how much the penalty is going to be. Here's an example of a... We have the film. Here's an example of the some of the 1/6G simulations we've done to measure metabolic penalties. In this particular case, the astronaut has 5/6 of his weight off the treadmill. We're taking metabolic data through the visor. We've also run tests of this order at Langley using the inclined plane 1/6G simulator. You can see here why we added the ankle joint. It's rather a stiff walk without them. This slide summarizes the results of some of the metabolic testing we've done to date. You can see that for a 1G configuration, we can expect that the spacesuit will require about 100% growth in metabolic expenditure. However, in the 1/6G environment, we recoup a good share of that. In fact, it looks like the two situations are almost equivalent, the unpressurized 1G and the 3.76G. We can expect from this data that the man should be able to walk at about 2 to 3 miles per hour on the lunar surface, depending upon the terrain. Of course, not knowing exactly what the terrain will be, we expect that it might, he probably will be making about 1 to 2 miles per hour with that factor thrown in. To date, most of the data has been taken on treadmills because it offers a convenient standard of measurement. More tests are being planned, of course, both at 1G and 1/6G, and we hope to include the various surfaces and the conditions associated to assess the metabolic penalties. EMU failure modes, which constrain the lunar mission, are primarily directly associated with expendable usage and therefore determine the time, the amount of that the astronaut has to return. For example, one of the more critical failures is a fan malfunction. If it occurred, the astronaut would, of course, have to return immediately to the ship. The remedial action in this case would be for the astronaut to pull his Green Apple emergency oxygen supply system and then induce a leak into the suit through a valve which allows flow from the regulated sources in the backpack to purge the helmet at about 2 pounds per hour. This is really about 1.9 cubic feet per minute, and depending upon the failure mode, of course, we'll give him from 5 minutes to 26 minutes. The 26-minute constraint here is based on the fact that if the astronaut leaves the ship and walks, by the time he gets to 26 minutes, he's consumed enough of his primary oxygen to allow him at 2 pounds per hour, 26 minutes, to get back. This envelope decreases as he's out longer because of the less oxygen available to him for return. If the astronaut works harder or has a greater suit leakage, of course, this envelope will change. For instance, the spacesuit specification is that it not leak more than 200 standard cubic centimeters per minute. The astronaut will perform a leak check before he leaves. However, he'll use a relatively small suit-mounted gauge and use a pressure decay technique, and it's difficult to see gross leakages. Therefore, about the only thing he'll see is the fact that he has his connections properly made. It'll be up to the ground monitoring systems and his own monitoring devices to keep track of his return status at all times. I'd like to bring out now the extravehicular assembly. Prance out, I guess is the term. All set? This is a full EMU. We do have some prototype hardware on it. You got enough line? Okay. Can you show? Bill, are you going to come on? Can you show us the motions of up and up, putting the visor up, bring the visor down? Yep. On the final model, we'll have tabs so that he doesn't have to actually touch the visor. And he can put them up quite readily. Is the cam mechanism still acting up?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We're going to perform this with the visor down. He has enough transmission with the stage lights to see what's going on. I want to show you some shoulder mobility right now. Shoulder mobility, right. You can see that the reach capability with the suit in conjunction with the shoulder, the elbow, and the wrists are much more significant. Can you show us some of the wrist and hand dexterity? He is, in fact, able to rotate his arms and wrists quite easily. Let's try picking up your leg for thigh and knee. He's at 3.7 PSI. This particular backpack, of course, is a mock-up using a cryogenic system, and it weighs much more than it would in 1.6G, and so even the weight and the constraints of the 1G environment, he's able to perform quite adequately. These maneuvers should be much easier for him on the lunar surface. Can you reach your PLSS controls and displays?
PLSS controls.
On the right-hand side. PLSS controls are located at the right lower corners of each side. One side contains the communications and electrical switches. The other side contains the manual oxygen and water valves. He can reach the emergency oxygen system, and I think you can see the green apple there. In fact, normally he won't have to operate only other than two controls of the PLSS out on the lunar surface, the water control valve and the communications valve. Do you have the gas connector? One of the critical maneuvers here is the fact that he'd be able to make and break the gas connectors in a pressurized suit when he comes back in or when he's leaving the LEM to transfer from the PLSS to the environmental control system. This particular case, it's a little worse than it would normally be. You can see he makes that quite easily pressurized without losing pressure. The visibility in this helmet is such that he can see the entire front of his suit. He can also see his boots and watch where he's walking quite easily. I'm going to ask him to get down and pick up a rock sample. I'm going to use my keys so they don't float off the stage. All right. 1.6G, this maneuver is much easier, although there's no effort involved there. Can we bring out the stepladder now? I'm going to ask him to climb a few steps on the stepladder to show that he can climb a ladder on the limb without too much trouble. Well, let me get the back of this ladder. He makes a pretty heavy assembly.
That's fine. That's good.
Come on down.
That's beautiful. The most difficult maneuver he's going to have to perform is, of course, getting up off of his back. This is exceedingly difficult in 1G. We're going to try it here because I think we're all set. He's tried it before. Can you go down? I'm going to kind of stand out in front of him here. In 1/6G, the astronaut can get up fairly easily from this position with training. It's a matter of pushing up from a down position.
You ready?
All set. This is extremely difficult. As you can see, he performs quite adequately. That concludes my demonstration and presentation. Thanks very much, Jack.
Are there any questions in this area? Yes, sir.
Can he walk sideways or look back? He can walk sideways, yes. He can walk in a sidestepping motion quite easily. Yes, no problem there.
More questions? Yes, Charlie.
I'm sorry. No, it's probably...
Bill,
it's,
let me state the question. What was the reason for the red helmet? Was that for heat balance?
No, it's supposed to be international orange. It's going to give us a... better means of seeing the astronaut on the lunar surface. We have super insulation behind the helmet shell, the extravehicular shell, and the degradation to thermal performance isn't severely affected by the international orange versus white. I guess everybody's hungry.
Yes, sir.
Which of the visors will be down during
the
normal excursion?
Well, which of the visors will be down during the normal excursion? The second visor is a relatively clear visor. It has a low emissive coating to keep the inside surface temperatures of the visor down. That would normally be down during a good share of the excursion. The outer visor is a gold-coated visor and can be brought down all the way or partially if he only wants shading. However, if he's going to be working in the direct sunlight, he'd probably want the outer visor down. The inner visor is really a lunar night visor to control the temperature more.
If there are no more questions, I think that we ought to proceed with the next speaker. We ran a little...
...is a gold-coated visor and can be brought down all the way or partially if he only wants shading. However, if he's going to be working in the direct sunlight, he'd probably want the outer visor down. The inner visor is really a lunar night visor to control the temperature more.